Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and as always, I'm joined by my co-presenter John Dorney from theirishstory.com. If you'd like to listen to this or any previous episodes of the show, you can go to the Near FM podcast page on nearfm.ie/podcast, or check out our Facebook page on facebook.com/theirishhistoryshow. We're on Twitter on twitter.com/irishhistorypod, and you can also email us at history@near.ie. Now, this is going to be a slightly different episode. We don't have a guest in studio. We're just going to talk about a couple of issues, a couple of history issues that are taking our fancy at the moment. And one of them, as we're recording this, I think we're 2 days away from the Scottish vote on independence. So we're going to look at Scotland and Ireland, a couple of comparisons between the independence struggles and how they cross over and how they differ. And we're going to look at something that John's been working on, an article about different nations after the First World War, particularly in Eastern Europe, seeing how they compare to Ireland, other nationalities that were looking for their own states after the war. So first up, John, I think we'll look at Scotland, and particularly because it's very apt at the moment. If you're going to do a comparisons, has there ever really been that same desire for home rule or independence in Scotland as there is in Ireland?
Short answer, no. But Scotland and the Union has a totally different history to Ireland. I mean, don't forget that Britain can be traced back really to 1603, when the King of Scotland became the King of England. Mm. And then the Union in 1707 was voluntarily voted through by the Scottish Parliament, which was a more or less representative institution, which couldn't be said about the Irish Parliament, which also voted through the Act of Union in 1801, but or 1800, and it was passed in 1801, but it wasn't a representative institution, and even that was pretty much coerced into voting for the Union. So Ireland was always in a much more, you'd almost say, abused position within the Union than Scotland ever was. Scotland was always much more of a voluntary partner. Scotland was a contributor to the British Empire, a beneficiary of the British Empire, a beneficiary of the main movements in British history, like the Industrial Revolution, democratisation of local government, the rise of socialism, of labourism, none of which applied to Ireland, really. So in lots of ways, the dynamics of Irish and Scottish history, I think, are very different. I don't know if you'd agree with me on that.
Well, I think when we're looking at Scottish nationalism, like, the SNP doesn't really become a force in Scotland until much later in the 20th century. I think the one by-election that they did win becomes such a big issue and such a turning point for Scottish nationalism, but still only one seat at Westminster. Scotland conforms to the British party system of Labour, Tory and Liberal. In a way that Ireland doesn't.
Yeah, and this is what I mean. Scotland isn't part of the mainstream of Britain, and Ireland never was.
But I think when we're thinking about particularly the Liberal Party and the Celtic Fringe, there was a time, I think, in the early 20th century where the idea of home rule all around,
that's right,
and not just for Ireland, but also for Scotland and Wales, and maybe some people might even say Cornwall.
Yeah.
But even during the 20th century, you see, like, Cornwall, and up to today, the Highlands and Islands of Scotland still remain Liberal.
Yeah, strange one, but true, yeah.
Even when the Liberal Party in England was reduced to a very tiny rump, mm-hmm, during large parts of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you go back to the 19th century, you can't really compare it to either to now or even to the early 20th century, because the vote was so much more restricted. But of course, Irish nationalists used to vote for the Liberal Party, mm-hmm, before the rise of the Home Rule Party. Or Irish Catholics probably is better, more accurate at that time, like in the mid-19th century. So it did apply to Ireland. But again, what you see more is the Irish difference, or I was going to say, like, the Irish exceptionalism, like they say about America. Because, you know, in the 1870s and 1880s, you have a rise of a particular Irish nationalism, which became the dominant force in Ireland. And again, like you said, the SNP weren't a serious force really up until the 1990s, I would say, no?
Yeah.
So that's a major difference.
I think something as well, and something that we're seeing in this referendum at the moment, is that all the mainstream British parties, the Liberal Democrats, Labour and Conservative, are all coming out against Scottish independence. And I wonder if independence is passed, how that will affect their votes in a new independent Scotland.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, all right. I mean, like, obviously the Labour Party will probably be concerned about losing a big block of voters, who are more or less reliable voters, or have been up to now in the United Kingdom context. I'd imagine, though, I think a good comparison might be Spain, because what you're seeing there is where devolution has gone a bit further in terms of Catalonia, the Basque Country. The Socialist Party kind of has its own identity in both of those places. They're not nationalists, but they're more nationalistic than Madrid would like them to be as well. I'd say, I could be wrong now, but I would, because Labour in Scotland has historically been very influential. I mean, Gordon Brown very recently was the Prime Minister. So it does have a kind of a strong British identity. But I'd say what you're looking at, if the independence is passed, is a new Scottish Labour Party. And while the Conservatives, is, of course, their identity is so bound up with the Union and the British project or the British Empire, I don't know, might be a different thing.
Well, I heard an interview there with Tom Devine, a Scottish professor, saying that he was in favour of a yes vote, who was drawing attention to an opinion poll where nearly half of Rangers supporters who had been canvassed said they were going to vote for independence. So it is interesting that what would be viewed as bastions of Scottish loyalism, that the divide over yes, no or independence in Scotland isn't really falling the way we would imagine it, seeing it through an Irish prism.
That's right. And one of the interesting things, I think, and one of the main things that's made this possible, this referendum, is that Scottish nationalism and Scottish society has changed.
Mm.
You know, if you go back to the early 20th century, Scottish nationalism was very much a Protestant phenomenon. It was probably anti-Irish and anti-Catholic at a time when that was a big issue in Scotland, with the mass immigration from mostly from the north of Ireland. I think the erosion of that identity, of the sectarian identities on both sides in Scotland, has made this possible, because previously, people who were very strongly identified with Protestant loyalist kind of identity would have been very much imperialist or loyalist. And people of Catholic Scots, especially of Irish background, would have been diehard Labour supporters and would have been against being stranded in what they would have seen as a potentially sectarian state. I mean, the erosion of that, I think, is a big contributor to the present situation.
Well, I think as well, especially if we look at 1979, there was a devolution vote about granting Scotland their own parliament, and it was defeated. And I think that idea at the time that socialism equated to internationalism, and that any type of regional nationalism was damaging to the working class as a whole throughout Britain.
Yeah, that would have been a much stronger idea at the time. And the Labour Party would have been much stronger, not only in terms of votes or whatever, but I mean ideologically much stronger. People believed in it much more. I mean, I think you've seen this in all social democratic parties, but especially I think in Britain.
Hmm.
The Labour Party's been hollowed out, and people, especially their traditional supporters, see that they really don't believe in a whole lot anymore, you know, besides being in power.
Well, there's a lot of the bedrock of Scottish industrialisation seems to have gone, especially during the Thatcher period, the shipbuilding and the Clyde and things like that. And I think a lot of the argument for Scottish independence is coming from a left-wing perspective.
Definitely, yeah. It's not very noticeable this, that social democracy is sort of the dominant discourse in Scotland, which is unusual in Britain as a whole.
I think what's absent in Scotland, if we compare it, now you can't really compare Scotland in 2014 to Ireland pre-World War I.
1914, yeah.
In 1914 or 1918 or even 1921. There doesn't appear to be any very orthodox Republican position or people saying vote no because it doesn't offer us an independent republic.
Yeah, although it does actually. So it's again a massive difference. It's difficult to imagine that happening in Ireland, that they saying we'll respect the result of whatever you decide. Yeah. But no, yeah, you're right. And I think again, hopefully we can talk about this in more depth, which is like there's a big difference in the militancy in which nationalism is conceived in Scotland and Ireland.
Yeah.
And there's good historical reasons, as we talked about, for that. But it was possible to be Scottish and British without contradiction, pretty much. And it was never possible to be Irish and British without contradiction. I think there is a small Scottish Socialist Republican Party, actually, which had some affiliation with the IRSP. But no, it's all but non-existent. And another big difference, though, between, again, you're right, it's difficult to compare a century on. But another big difference is the apparent absence of cultural nationalism, which was obviously so important in early 20th century Irish nationalism. I mean, the links between Ireland and Scotland go back to the early medieval period. It's, you know, the Gaelic language in Scotland is the same as the language in Ireland. They're variations of the same language. But a Gaelic identity, a separate ethnic identity, that doesn't seem to play a part in the discourse about the referendum at all. Whereas, you know, you can't read through a speech of an Irish Republican or Irish Nationalist in the early 20th century without reading the word Gael and True Gael and so forth several times. That's a massive difference.
Yeah, you do see a bit of a growth of Scots Gaelic since the SNP have got in, and
devolution, of course.
Devolution and regional broadcasting and on radio and TV. But you don't have a case where Alex Salmond begins his speech as Oscalia.
Like Gerry Adams, exactly. Yeah, no, completely.
And do you think that helps Scottish nationalism in a way, that it makes it more open?
We've talked about the erosion of sectarian identity, and I think that part of the SNP, I believe, used to be more kind of Gaelicist, and that's gone. And the idea that it's totally a civic nationalism now, it's defined solely by being in Scotland and wanting to be part of Scotland, I think, yeah, is basically a good thing. Although I wouldn't... the part of me inherited by my great-grandfather, who was a Gaelic League scholar, tells me that it's, you know, it's sad that the Gaelic language and the Gaelic identity seems to be very fragile in Scotland, and they don't seem to take much identification with it as a whole, outside of some areas of the Highlands. As a whole, I think it's a good thing because, you know, Scottish nationalism doesn't seem to say, well, if you don't conform to X, Y, and Z, then you're not a real Scot. So that has to be a good thing, I think.
Well, it'd be interesting to see what happens, because there is still this debate at the moment, and by the time the podcast goes out, we'll know which way the vote has gone. But there's still issues that haven't really been clarified during the campaign. Things to do with currency and exactly what level of independence there will be. Independence seems to be sort of a catch-all word. But are we talking about, for want of a better word, Dominion Home Rule, a similar situation to Canada and Australia and New Zealand, with the potential to, at some stage, leave the Commonwealth, have a Republican form of government?
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, yeah, I think the SNP have said that they're committed to keeping the monarchy. So I guess that's kind of a sop to the loyalist element in Scotland. It's difficult to say. I mean, one thing that strikes me is the issue of defence and military sovereignty. The Scottish component of the British Army has historically been very important. The United Kingdom has very important naval bases, including nuclear bases in Scotland. I don't know if anyone has really addressed what's going to happen there. I mean, are the Scottish units of the British Army going to be disbanded? Are they going to be a part of a Scottish Army? Are they going to have joint defence? Could happen. You know, we tend to forget about this in Western Europe. I think events in places like Ukraine especially remind people that sovereignty in the end is defended by guns, unfortunately, even today.
Well, some of the Yes campaigners have been talking about the fact that they would remove Trident from Scotland. Nuclear missiles are based in Scotland. And I thought, quite interestingly, I don't know how much this has been either supported or resented during the campaign, but President Obama has come out against Scottish independence.
Yeah, Bill Clinton actually.
Bill Clinton as well.
And the Chinese are not keen on it as well, I believe.
Well, I suppose the Taiwan situation.
Well, there's that too. And the Spanish for the same reason. You know, because they're restive regions, and places like Serbia are probably not too crazy about it either. But yeah, I think from the United States point of view, it's about the posture of NATO being weakened.
Sort of reminiscent of that TV drama in the early 80s, A Very British Coup.
Yeah.
Which is up on YouTube if anyone wants to watch it. What happens when a very left-wing government gets elected in the UK and decides to leave NATO and get rid of all nuclear weapons from the island, and the coup is launched with support of the US. Not saying that's going to happen, but...
No.
The US do not seem to be very happy about...
No, they wouldn't like it, no. For sure. And, you know, the people of Scotland will speak, and by the time this podcast is broadcast, we'll know what they will have decided. So this might be all academic, or it might all be up for question.
Well, the obvious question then, if Scotland votes yes, how will that affect relationships between Ireland and Britain, between Ireland North and South, and a UK composed solely of England, Wales and Northern Ireland? How will that work?
Yeah. For Northern Ireland especially, obviously, it's kind of a pressing issue. A couple of things strike me. Number one, I mean, the unionist identity in the north is very bound up with Scotland. A lot of their ancestors, of course, are come from Scotland. Scotland is geographically very close to Northern Ireland. And there's a lot of, you know, there's always been, even, and as I said, going back to medieval times and before that, it's always been almost one region, the north of Ireland and Scotland. So sentimentally, it'll be a big blow for a lot of unionists in the north of Ireland if Scotland left. It would break up the union. It would also increase pressure for more powers to be handed over to Stormont and the local government. Or should I describe it as that? Whatever it's called, the devolved government there. I mean, Sinn Féin have explicitly stayed out of this, but I'm sure they see that if Scotland votes yes, then their calls for a border poll will have more credence, which could in the future be kind of a destabilising factor. I personally wouldn't be too crazy about a border poll in the near future.
Is there any point, though, in... for Sinn Féin and calling for a border poll until the opinion polls reflect that there might be a chance of it succeeding?
Yeah, That's true. I mean, the last opinion poll said only 25% of Northern population would go for United Ireland right away. You wouldn't know how accurate that is. Mm. I suspect it might be a bit more than that. But, yeah, I don't know. I really don't know what the strategy is there as regards Sinn Féin.
And I suppose with what would become the UK then, England, Wales and Northern Ireland, for want of a better term, we essentially have joint authority in the North. So then your UK is really England and Wales.
Mm.
And unlike Ireland and Scotland, Wales isn't a kingdom, it's a principality. It doesn't really have this a separate legal system. Or
no, like Scotland always had, actually.
So I wonder, will that lead to increased calls for further devolution in Wales, because the level of Welsh self-government isn't the same as what Scotland has present.
I mean, I think Welsh identity is very interesting, though, because Welsh identity and the level of what the Gaelic nationalists in Ireland would have understood is actually very strong. The Welsh language is very strong, it's very healthy. But Welsh separatism is very weak, which is kind of an interesting contradiction. It's the opposite of what you'd expect going from like the ideology of Irish nationalists. Not the reality now, but the ideology. The big difference, though, I think, again, is just in practical terms, is that Wales doesn't have oil or doesn't have any really healthy economy. Wales has mass unemployment. And I think people in Wales are realistic enough to know that independence isn't an option at the moment. But certainly, yeah, I'd imagine that they'd be pushing for more devolved powers.
What's funny, I heard an interview there with an English Conservative politician saying that if Scotland was to vote no and remain in the Union, there should be a separate English Parliament. If the Scottish Parliament gets increased powers, which really calls into question what role then for Westminster. If Scotland, Wales and England and Northern Ireland all have their own assemblies or parliaments, and they're voting on most issues to do with local issues, how much power then should Westminster have outside of foreign affairs? And
yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, that would be a real federal system where the centre would only have foreign affairs, military, you know, stuff like that. You know, exchange rates, currency. One of the things, though, strikes me is that the world is changing. You know, borders are being redrawn all over the world now. And as regards the United Kingdom, one of the unspoken background to the Scottish referendum is that the incredible dominance of London now in the United Kingdom. Like, London is not really an English city anymore, a British city. Like, it's a multinational city. But some very large proportion of the UK's wealth is made and it's concentrated in London. So essentially, there's a city-state in London, you know, which has its own mayor now, which is more important, really, than the rest of the United Kingdom economically. And it subsidises the rest of the United Kingdom, but it also sucks pretty much the life out of it. And it's also concentrated in what you'd have to describe as sort of non-productive industries like finance. Like, it doesn't produce anything. Hmm. So, I mean, you know, 100 years down the line, conceivably, we could be talking about a city-state of London cut off from other self-governing parts who might be like underdeveloped regions by European Union standards kind of thing. You know, the world is changing and all kinds of things are possible. I'm not saying that will happen, but
it'd be interesting to see in 50 years' time how important national boundaries or even national states become for countries that remain within the European Union.
That's another question. And of course, Britain wants to leave our part. Yeah, well, England really, I suppose we have to say now, wants to leave the European Union. So who knows? I mean, but the world is changing, that's for sure.
We might move on to the World War One in Eastern Europe, because we are talking about nationalisms and we are talking about new states. A recommendation from yourself, I started listening to those podcasts, the New Books podcasts on a whole range of different issues. If you just type in New Books, but New Books in History. And something that I didn't know a huge amount about was Europe after the wars. Europe after the First World War and then Europe after the Second World War. Just how difficult a situation it was for the people who had survived the wars, particularly after the Second World War. But after the First World War, a lot of the things we describe in Ireland that were brought about by the First World War, like the potential for independence and how much the First World War changed the political situation in Europe. How did you find the situation when you compared Ireland and the desire for self-government to other smaller national minorities within other states, such as the Poles, Czechs, the Baltic states?
Yeah, I think there's some quite close parallels to be drawn there. And just I've been trying to gather material on this because I think there's it's quite interesting because then you see how Ireland isn't as unique as people might think it is. It looks very different in Western European terms, but actually it's more or less the norm in terms of most of Central and Eastern Europe. So if we take stateless nations, like nations that want to be states, in pre-1914 Europe, Poland is divided three ways, had been since the late 18th century, between originally the Prussians, but now the Germans, and in the west, between the Russians in the east and the Austrians kind of to the south, in what was known as Galicia, which also is part of present-day Ukraine, but was then part of the Habsburg Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. If you take Poland, like nationalism was very strong in Poland. As like Ireland, it was a very Catholic movement. Probably the Poles were more harshly treated in the sense of the Polish language was made illegal, which has parallels perhaps with the 17th century in Ireland, but was not such a feature by the, or not so important really by the 19th century. Also, I mean, there was land reform in Ireland, whereas in German Poland, they were actually passed a law saying Poles couldn't own land over a certain amount. So it's like more like the penal laws in Ireland going back to the 18th century. In the Russian case, you basically, the Poles suffered from the repression that the Tsar exerted on everybody else in the empire. But also, I mean, there's a policy of Russification, where the Russian language was trying to be enforced in schools. And there were very long terms of conscription in the Tsarist army as well, which was a grievance for Poles. And also there was very harsh repression. So nationalists would be deported off to Siberia. I mean, that didn't start with Stalinists, I'm afraid. That goes back to the early 19th century. The Czechs fared better in the Habsburg Empire, which was a more liberal empire. But again, they lobbied at the Imperial Parliament. Well, first of all, again, the Habsburg Empire is an autocracy, basically. But they did have a parliament. It was a mixture of both, like Germany, for that matter. But a little bit more liberal. The Baltic states were under the Tsar as well. But during the war itself, so the first thing that strikes me is that, like Ireland, these were countries which were part of the war effort of the empires they were occupied by, whether they wanted to or not. Now, in Ireland's case, there was a bit more consent than there was in these countries. I mean, Britain was not a democracy, I wouldn't say, at that point, because of the restriction of the vote. It was closer to being a democracy that we would understand, certainly, than the empires of Eastern Europe. although they were all had some aspects of democracy as well. And in some cases had a wider franchise, actually, than the British Parliament. Whereas conscription, obviously, was a massive issue in Ireland, and part of the reason for the rise of Sinn Féin and separatism was the resistance to conscription. There was never any question in these countries I've mentioned that there would be conscription. Their men were taken and they were put into uniform, and they served in these armies of these rival empires. We talk a lot in Ireland about the casualties of war and how high they were. Now, the number in Ireland is, it seems to be kind of up in the air now. I mean, there was, originally the kind of canonical number was 50,000. And people went and looked through the records and brought it down to 30,000. Now people are bringing it back up again by going through newspapers and so forth. So it's somewhere between 30,000 and 60,000. Now, the number in Poland is something like 500,000 dead in the war. Now, that's in all three empires they were fighting for. I remember they had to fight against each other. I don't have the figures for what became Czechoslovakia or what are in the Baltic states. But you're looking at very high numbers. You're looking at hundreds of thousands because there were millions of men forcibly put into uniform. And the other thing is that Ireland was spared being actually a battleground, whereas all of these countries, well, not the Czech Republic, or Czechoslovakia as it was then, or the Czech lands, in fact, as it was then, I wasn't fought over, but the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and Poland were crisscrossed several times by rival German and Russian and Austrian armies. And the material devastation was very significant. That was about 200,000 civilians died in the war in Poland as well, on top of the military deaths. So that's, you know, that's a much higher number.
Well, that's the thing. I suppose we'd have a very different understanding of the Somme and Gallipoli if the Irish people who died there had been conscripts and even unwilling conscripts.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, John Redmond actually, he advised the British government in 1916, I forget if it was before or after the Rising, to be honest, but he advised the British government it would be impossible to impose conscription in Ireland, which has been interpreted two ways. Like, the British were very magnanimous or the British were realistic. I think it's probably a little bit of both. But certainly, I mean, as I said, if you lived, for example, in the Tsarist Empire or the German Empire, it simply wasn't a question, you know. There was a quota of conscripts. You were drafted and you had no choice. It was that or go on the run to the forests, which people did. But there certainly wasn't a question of, will we consult your political representatives? What I find very interesting, though, an idea I'm trying to develop is that, whereas in Ireland, the major sort of political effect of the war and the resistance to the war was against conscription. Now, that didn't apply in the countries I've talked about. But what is very interesting is, and again, and actually in Ireland, when the Germans tried to raise a military unit based on Irish prisoners of war, Roger Casement, it was very unsuccessful. They'd only about 50 recruits. Now, by total contrast, in the countries where, I remember the Irish soldiers were volunteers. Now, by total contrast, the French and the French managed to raise a division of Polish soldiers who had been in the German army. A whole division. I mean, this is, I think that's about 10,000 men. Or 20,000. No, I think the number is about 20,000 men, which the Poles called the Blue Army because of the French blue uniform, to fight on the opposite side. And they're with the aim of going back to liberate Poland, which they did after the war. And similarly, the Russians raised a Czech Legion from Czech prisoners of war, and Slovak, actually, prisoners of war. So I view that as being basically analogous to the resistance to conscription in Ireland, but it's probably what happens when you do conscript minority nationalities. Another interesting parallel, though, is that even kind of retracing my steps, but even before the war, we're very familiar in Ireland with the rival volunteer movements which were set up, the Ulster Volunteers, the Irish Volunteers. The same thing was happening in Eastern Europe, interestingly enough. I mean, the Poles set Marshal Piłsudski, who was the famous Polish saviour after the war, I'll get to that in a sec, but he set up a Polish military organisation before the war, clandestine militia. Likewise, in Latvia and Lithuania, the Lithuanian Riflemen Volunteer Association was set up. And this kind of spirit was kind of sweeping Europe, I think, at the time. But after the war, there's a lot of parallels because these countries, which I'm talking about, emerged. Czechoslovakia was kind of a union of Czechs and Slovaks, which, as we know, much later on fell apart. Mm-hmm. But at that time, that was the thing, and I think it was popular at the time among both the Czechs and the Slovaks, emerged from the wreckage of the Habsburg Empire. Poland emerged from the wreckage of three empires. And the Baltic states emerged, again, from the chaos of the downfall of the Tsarist Empire in Russia. What's different about, and Ireland, obviously, the 26 counties became more or less independent in 1922. What's different, though, is that whereas the Irish nationalists, Irish separatists fought against a more or less coherent state, what happened in Eastern and Central Europe was the existing states collapsed because they lost the war. Even the Russians lost the war. They lost the war, of course, the year before the Germans did. And they collapsed into revolution and civil war themselves. So I think that the result of this was that the independence struggles and the struggles for independence were much bloodier and much more violent in Eastern and Central Europe because of the actual collapse of state power. Mm. So they're much more anarchic. Also, they're much less control over violence. The units I've talked about, the Polish Blue Army, the Czech Legion, and the various paramilitaries, very often recruited from soldiers who weren't even properly demobilised. They just went home with their weapons. There was a book recently brought out by Trinity College here in Dublin about the war after the war. I think the original title was The Greater War. And what's very interesting about it is the rise of paramilitaries in Eastern and Central Europe in the context of the collapse of all these empires. And one which many people will have heard of is the Freikorps in Germany. And what we associate the Freikorps with in Germany is the putting down of the socialist uprisings in Germany from 1918 to 1923. And they were, in some ways, proto-fascists. You know, there were many of their ideas and some of their people were later on Nazis. But what we forget in Western Europe is that the Freikorps were in action all over Eastern Europe where Germans lived in an effort to sort of reclaim and to keep places where Germans lived. And the Freikorps carried out, you know, horrific massacres in places like Riga, which we've totally forgotten about, and which, remember, were German cities in the Middle Ages, you know, or only recently Latvian cities, for example. The Freikorps were active in Poland, in the province of Silesia, where there was a pretty vicious conflict between Polish nationalists and German nationalists. And again, there weren't really any regular forces here between paramilitaries, which makes it probably less controlled and more violent, more indiscriminate. But Poland itself raised a kind of a scratch national army from various paramilitary groups, returned prisoners, organised mainly by Piłsudski, who had been, he had lived in Russian Poland, and he had sort of sided with the Germans during the war, but he was locked up by the Germans for failing to totally take their side. But the point I'm trying to make is that the Poles fought no less than 9 different wars after the First World War to define their borders. Some of them were probably what we'd regard and what the Poles today certainly regard as heroic battles for national self-determination. The war against the Germans in Silesia, the war against the Red Army in 1920 when the Red Army, the Bolshevik Army, tried to annex Poland. But a lot of the wars were less than noble. I mean, the Poles fought campaigns in the Baltic states and Lithuania. They took a province off the Czechs. Again, this, while there is obviously quite a lot of violence in Ireland after the First World War, there's up to 5,000 deaths, it just doesn't compare to this zone where the states have collapsed altogether and are put back together more or less by paramilitaries on all sides.
Well, it's interesting that always amazes me when I look at the borders between the wars. It's just how much the borders of Poland changed in 30 years. And you were talking there about Silesia and different provinces. One of the things that I would be interested in is just how would you define nationalities at that stage? Were they very strict or were they movable in a way? I think somebody once said, I heard another interview, that if a bunch of German nationalists came in and attacked your town, you were a Pole.
That's right.
But if it was a bunch of Polish nationalists coming in, you were a German.
Yeah, or the other way around, you might. Yeah.
Especially how multilingual you were as well played into it.
That's right. And the, a historian called Timothy Wilson recently wrote a book about this, about the province of Silesia and comparing it to Ulster. And his point, interestingly enough, was, I mean, Ulster in a way is the best comparison in Ireland because it's a place where you have like communal conflict, which you don't really have in the rest of Ireland, you know, with provisions of places like West Cork, where there was some elements of sectarianism. But basically, in Ulster, it's the only place where you have two communities fighting each other. And his point was that in Ulster, where it was defined by religion and history, barriers between communities were very strict. And because you're either Catholic or a Protestant, and you have to go through a formal process of conversion. Whereas in Silesia, which is on the borderlands between Poland and Germany, and most of the people spoke a language, a dialect, which was a combination of Polish and German. And they could have identified as either one. So it's very interesting. And he said it was an ideological choice. And I mean, one of the things, the parallels which strikes me, is that Ireland is lucky in a way because it's an island. And the borders are very, very easy to define.
Yeah.
You know, anybody in Ireland is Irish, obviously. Now, clearly it hasn't been as straightforward as that. But it's much more straightforward than it is in much of Central Europe. Because you've got groups who lived in empires for thousands of years, basically. Many of whom, before the 20th century, had never much thought about whether they wanted to be a nation or not, because it wasn't relevant to their existence. They were ruled by aristocrats of whatever nationality. Quite often they were German, but they could also be Polish or Ukrainian, or Ukrainians who became Poles, and so on and so forth. But the Czechs used to call themselves Bohemians. The Czechs changed religion in the 16th century, you know, and they changed their allegiances, political allegiances, basically. But yeah, it was a very fluid situation, and very difficult to decide who was who. Ukraine is another example. Now, Ukraine I didn't talk about before because it doesn't really compare very well to Ireland. I mean, Ukraine was caught up in the anarchy of the Russian Civil War, and Ukrainian nationalism was probably less strong in Ukraine than Bolshevism, I would say, or even anarchism. There was an anarchist army at large in Ukraine, and it was much more kind of violent, chaotic situation. Like, I mean, Kiev was occupied 9 or 10 times by different armies. But again, Ukrainians sort of could choose what they wanted to be, because Ukraine historically had been part of Poland. Ukraine's claimed part of Poland. A lot of what is present day Poland is now, present day Ukraine, excuse me, is now, or was then, part of Poland and was historically part of Poland. And there was a lot of bloodshed in Western Ukraine and Eastern Poland over who was who and which side you wanted to belong to. Now, there was a religious difference there as well, which possibly hardened it. But certainly, interwar Poland had quite a lot of Ukrainians in it who didn't want to be part of it, who didn't want to be there. But for the Poles, this was part of historical Poland. And this is obviously a thing you see all over Central Europe. And I mean, most recently you see this in Kosovo, where Kosovo was historically Serbian, but it has a majority Albanian population. And especially after the First World War, this produced violent conflicts all over Eastern Europe.
And unfortunately, the poor Jewish population of Eastern Europe are caught between different, in many cases, right-wing nationalists competing over land.
Absolutely. I mean, and even in the First World War, something that scholars are only looking at in the last 10 years, I think, in the Eastern Front in the First World War, the Jewish population suffered quite a lot from rival armies, from the Russian army, the Tsarist army, the German Imperial army. Not to the extent of the Second War, obviously, but suffered considerably. As regards the nation-states which emerged in Eastern and Central Europe, Poland is a really interesting case, because Poland was something like 30% Jewish, a very large Jewish population. The historian Timothy Snyder has recently argued that Poland was the homeland of the Jews. You know, not in the sense of what should be like Israel, or that argument, the Zionist argument, but it actually was the homeland of the Jews before the Holocaust. Something like 80% of world Jewry lived in Poland. What's interesting about the nation states, though, is that on the one hand, you had people like Piłsudski. Again, his conception of Poland was like the historical Poland, the Commonwealth of Poland, where everyone in Poland, like we talked about with Scottish nationalism, everyone in Poland was a Pole. And the same is true in places like Greece, which had quite a large Jewish population, and to a lesser extent other Eastern European countries, but Poland is the main one. And there's both. I mean, there's people who say we want the Jewish people to be more Polish, to speak Polish, because remember, the Jewish populations generally spoke Yiddish at the time. there wasn't just a religious thing. There were basically a minority ethnicity as well. No, not basically. There were a minority ethnicity at the time. So if Poles have said we want the Jews to become Jewish Poles and to speak Polish and identify with Polish culture, and many of them did. Mm. On the other hand, you had Polish nationalists from the so-called National Democratic Party, who were what we understand as ethnic nationalists, who said, no, no Jew can ever be a Pole, essentially. Yeah. And also were very hostile to Ukrainians, who I talked about a little bit before.
So what was their solution? The expulsion of the Jews into Germany, or a separate homeland within Poland for Jews?
You know, they never really got around to this. I mean, because the other thing about Poland, which again is interesting parallel to our difference to Ireland, is that Poland wasn't able to remain a democracy. Like Czechoslovakia did. Czechoslovakia was the only Central European country which remained a democracy. But Poland became a kind of dictatorship. Piłsudski, again, he retired from politics, but then he led a coup. He remained in the background, a little bit like Mubarak in our time, of the Egyptian army. You know, the army was the arbiter of who was allowed to govern. There were sort of elections, but everybody knew the army really decided things. But interestingly enough, Piłsudski, who organised this military coup to stop what he called squabbling in the Polish parliament, was also a defender of pluralism. I mean, there was different ideas. There was ideas that the Jews should become Polish, but on the right, on the far right, you had the idea that the Poles should be expelled from Poland. And one of the ideas was the Jews would be expelled to Madagascar. True story. Yeah. And that they'd be a Polish colony. They'd be the first Polish colony in Madagascar. Some madcap story, but this is completely true. I mean, Poles, to some extent also, the Polish interwar government sponsored emigration to Israel or to Palestine, as it then was. Mm-hmm. So it's a complicated story. Now, if you're referring back to Ireland again, there's no straightforward parallel. Obviously, the Irish Free State had a Protestant minority to a certain extent. Originally of about 10%, but it fell quite quickly due to various factors. There probably isn't a straightforward parallel, although there are some cases of intolerance in interwar Ireland. There's the famous case of the librarian who Fianna Fáil didn't want appointed in Mayo because she was a Protestant. But I don't think...
It doesn't really compare to these.
It really doesn't compare. And again, it comes back to probably the fact that the state never collapsed into utter violence in Ireland. The fact that other nationalities are pressing on the borders makes everything in Ireland much more restrained, I think. Mm. Than in Eastern Europe.
I suppose as well, as we're discussing Britain too, the Scots, the Welsh and the English, they're pretty much, they have their own corners of the island. But it is a frightening story, particularly Europe after the Second World War, the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. It's incredible.
I mean, the Second World War is even another level of violence again. Like I was talking about before, which I had never heard of before. I mean, for example, the Freikorps, the German right-wing paramilitaries marched into Riga and killed 3,000-5,000 people, you know, in an effort to terrorise the Latvians. You know, they wanted to claim it for Germany. I mean, that's pretty savage stuff, and it does prefigure what happened later on. But again, the level of violence during and after the Second World War and the level of population displacement, again, is unthinkable.
Yeah.
It does, I think, give the lie to people who talk about the revolutionary years in Ireland and use terms like ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
Just a simple comparison will tell you whatever happened in Ireland doesn't even bear comparison with what happened in places which invented the term ethnic cleansing.
I think the numbers of Germans who were forced to move after the Second World War, they're what, 10 to 12 million maybe? And another 2 million killed civilians.
Yeah, and which again actually is sort of a long-term product of the what they call the shatter zone of the First World War, because there had historically been a very large German population all over Eastern and Central Europe. And, you know, Hitler's idea of so-called Anschluss was actually a mainstream German nationalist, right-wing nationalist idea that you'd unite all the Germans. As I said, the Freikorps, the various Freikorps, because it's more of a chaotic movement than an organised one, had tried to unite them after the First World War. But certainly the ethnic Germans paid for the war the Nazis waged allegedly on their behalf in the Second World War.
What's funny as well is how do we define ethnic Germans or ethnic Poles? Mm. Is it linguistically, especially in somewhere like Germany, that's a religiously diverse country to begin with? Well,
that's right.
Different Christian denominations.
Yeah.
But like diverse ourselves. Within. Yeah. And throughout Eastern Europe, I think even now, Hungary has a large Romanian population and vice versa. Romania has a large Hungarian population.
Again, another product of the First World War, actually.
So will we ever get borders that completely identify with people's national aspirations in Europe, or are we going to get to a stage where borders become pretty much meaningless the more countries that come into the EU?
Okay, so I don't know the answer to that. I mean, my preference would certainly be more for the latter, where people could come and go as they pleased, more or less, would be certainly a better result than like ethnically pure countries, which I think is mythology anyway. You know, I mean, as we've discussed, like, nationality is something that people choose aspects of to create. You can't say people make it up from scratch, but you can certainly pick and choose. That's the reality, I think, in many countries.
Is it possible to know what Irish nationalists thought of the national issues in Europe in the immediate First World War?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I haven't really looked into it after the war. And I think Irish nationalists and separatists were busy with Irish affairs after the First World War. Mm-hmm. But before the First World War, what's interesting is that the Polish case and the oppression of the Polish nationality, as it was called in Germany and in Russia, was a kind of a popular cause in Western Europe, like not only among Irish nationalists. What the Irish Republican Brotherhood in their newspaper, Irish Freedom, would argue was, yes, the oppression of the Poles is terrible and we support the Poles' right to self-determination. But, I mean, the Irish language has been degraded so much they don't even have to make it illegal anymore. I think that the Polish cause was almost mainstream in Western Europe before the First World War. Honestly, I haven't really looked into what Irish nationalists made of events elsewhere in Europe after the First World War. Like I said, I think they were busy with events at home.
Do you think sometimes when they talk about British repression, they over-egg the pudding somewhat compared to what was going on in the rest of Europe?
Yeah, you'd have to say yes. The reality is that violence, both state violence and non-state violence in Ireland, was always restrained to a large degree. If you look at the most destructive conflict in Europe after the First World War was the Russian Civil War. And what you see in Russia is more or less unrestrained violence because the state has collapsed. There are rival factions fighting for power. There's a very strong element of ideology, obviously, with the Reds versus the Whites. But you're also looking at, in the most primitive terms, you're looking at various rival groups under no sort of conventions or restraints who are murdering each other, who are trying to exterminate each other for control of the state. And that didn't happen in Ireland, you know. I mean, even if we go to the end of the Irish Revolution and look at the Irish Civil War, which conceivably could have been two groups trying to exterminate each other for power of the country, but in practice it really didn't work like that. You know, in practice, yeah, you had a lot of very vicious violence, but there was something stopping people from murdering their political opponents en masse, you know, from carrying out mass executions. Mm. All the things which you see in Russia. You know, and the other thing, the other very destructive thing about the Russian Civil War is the systematic use of denying food to what you perceived as hostile populations and starving them. And people remember the Stalinist regime in the early 1930s doing this, but the reality is in the Civil War period, all sides did this. And I say all sides because you had the Bolshevik regime, you had the Whites, the Royalists, the Tsarists, you had Ukrainian nationalists, you had an anarchist army, as I said, in Ukraine, and you had the Czech Legion, who I referred to already, fighting on their own to try to get back to Czechoslovakia. Yeah. You know, you had the Baltic nationalists, who I referred to already. The Germans were mixed up there. You had a whirlwind of different groups committing violence. And the truth is that the fact that the states never completely collapsed, that the rule of law, to some extent, restrained violence in Ireland, is something that, in hindsight, we should probably be thankful for.
Now, getting into the realm of counterfactual history, if the First World War could have been avoided, and I suppose there's grounds to say if a couple of things would have went differently or if diplomacy would have succeeded, you could have avoided the First World War. Could you have avoided the ethnic breakdown and the ethnic infighting throughout Eastern Europe without displacing populations in some way?
The national question and the national wars in Eastern Europe and the civil wars happened because three empires collapsed: the German Reich, the Second Reich, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburg Empire, and the Tsarist Empire. It's not like there weren't powerful nationalist movements in all these countries anyway that I've talked about. There were, and in fact there were, as I mentioned, there were militarized nationalist movements in some of these countries. And there had also been the Balkan Wars right before the First World War, where the former provinces of the Ottoman Empire fought it out both with the Turkey and with each other over who should get what. Possibly, you know, ethnic and national conflict in Eastern Europe and Central Europe was inevitable to some degree. Without the First World War, it might not have been so violent, without so many returning soldiers, without, like I said, the collapse of the states involved. But I guess the question becomes then, so imagine no First World War, would these empires have had the possibility of continuing on in the form that they were in? And I'm not sure that they would have. I mean, the German Empire was probably a going concern, all right, because it was economically strong. To some extent, they'd managed to co-opt the democratic part of society, if you like. The social democrats were becoming kind of tamed. I mean, there probably would have been more democratization in Germany, I would have imagined. Whether that would have suited the Poles or not, don't know. I think the Tsarist Empire, you know, despite the fact people argue now that it was economically developing, I think was probably on the way out. Its political system was too out of sync with the society it was trying to govern, both in social and in national terms. The Habsburg Empire, similarly, you know, the Habsburg Empire could barely get anything done because of the different nationalities constantly squabbling. I mean, they had to give the Hungarians half the power in the empire in the late 19th century. And in the First World War, the Habsburg Empire was pretty weak because the different nationalities pulled in different directions, pretty much. At the risk of kind of, you know, the, like you said, counterfactual history and making it up, I would say the Habsburg Empire and the Russian Empire, the Tsarist Empire, were probably not long for the world anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, there would have been, I think, revolution in some form, national or social revolution in Russia. The Habsburg Empire probably would have fallen apart more peacefully because it was a much more liberal empire. The German Empire, again, hard to say, but let's say I would be sure that there would have been some sort of militarized Polish nationalist uprising, another one, as there had been more in the past. Mm. Anyway, to conclude, I'd say without the First World War, it wouldn't have been as violent as it was, and it wouldn't have had the horrifically violent sequel of the Second World War, probably, without the First World War.
That's very interesting and definitely something worth looking up. Looking forward to the article now, and in the meantime, I think there's some really, really interesting podcasts online about this period, both periods, the immediate aftermath of the First World War and the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. Just to say again, if anyone wants to check out this or previous episodes of the show, they should go to the Near FM podcast page and check out the previous episodes of the Irish History Show. If you want to follow us on Twitter, we're on Twitter on twitter.com/TheIrishHistoryPod. If you want to email us, we're at history@near.ie. And don't forget, please like us on Facebook. Please like us. We're facebook.com/TheIrishHistoryShow. So on behalf of myself, Carl Brennan, and my co-presenter, John Dorney from theirishstory.com, thanks very much for listening.